player, which apparently is the only one available. It's available only as an OEM product. Is that your understanding, first of all?
Best Technology, who are producing applications for the Linux system. I know the Cygnet Designs is a hardware application. I don't know exactly how it functions, but I will be happy to get more information to you when I find out the details of those licenses.
Please do.
I also wanted to mention that the DVD Copy Control Association was actually the organization responsible for administering the CSS licenses. Would be happy to supply the Copyright Office and the Register with any information that they would like. So I will try and get that information, but I would also suggest perhaps an inquiry to them, or maybe I should suggest to them that they file additional written statement with you.
The latter might be a good idea. Let's assume for a moment, though, that the statement is correct, that which means I assume that if I'm running a Linux operating system on my computer and I want to play a DVD, there is no way that I can do that unless I go out and buy a new computer which has this driver on as an OEM installation. Isn't that a problem?
I don't think it's a problem, because I think, first of all, if you have bought a DVD and you have a software operating system that doesn't support an application to play the DVD, you don't have to buy a new personal computer. You might need to purchase a new operating system, or you might need to purchase a new software application when it becomes available to play DVD to install on your computer. For example, even under the prevalent Windows operating system, and if I am misspeaking myself, I hope, and someone that's in the audience from Microsoft will correct me, but I think on prior versions of Microsoft, Microsoft Windows operating system, they didn't have a media player pre-installed on the Windows operating system that would allow for playback of DVDs. Therefore, if you purchased a DVD and you had a Windows operating system and you had a PC that had a DVD-ROM drive, you might still need to purchase a software application to enable your PC to play the DVD. So I really don't see where there's a great difference between that situation and the Linux situation.
Although anyone can download Media Player for free, I think, can't they?
That may be the case, but then there's no prohibition to a software developer in taking out a license to create the equivalent software application for the Linux system and making it available to its users for free.
But if no one has done that, why is it a problem for an individual user who wants to be able to watch that DVD on his own computer, which happens to run a Linux operating system, to do what he has to do so that he can view it?
The problem with it is that it's not simply a matter of the encryption and protection on the DVD disk guaranteeing the payment by that individual user for the copy of the disk. The whole purpose of the encryption in the first place is because it carries with it certain copy control obligations. As Ms. Gross correctly said, one of those obligations, for example, is that the content not be permitted to flow out of a digital outport from a computer. If a user is allowed to circumvent the technical protection measures, yes, that may enable the consumer to view the content from the DVD disc, but it may also, and likely would also, undermine the other protections that are inherent in the DVD system and allow for very easy unauthorized reproduction and distribution of the content of the DVD, for example, over the internet. So that's the risk that is entailed by allowing for that individual circumvention.
Ms. Gross, let's assume that between now and October 28th, Sigma or somebody else do release whatever equipment it is for commercial purchase, so you can go down to CompUSA or wherever and buy what you need to put on your machine, running the Linux operating system, and view DVDs. Is that going to moot the issue, at least with respect to Linux users?
Well, the problem is that there are additional operating systems that are being created every day, and individuals should not be required to go out and purchase a $10,000 license in order to build an application that'll play their DVDs. That's something that would be unprecedented in other forms of media. Additionally, there are problems with there are antitrust problems for tying the hardware, the machine, to the software itself, the DVD. Microsoft is about to be broken up for this very reason, and so I think we need to think about antitrust implications and tying the two together as well.
Okay, but let's focus just on Linux users. I know there are other operating systems out there, but certainly from personal experience I can say, having looked at the comments that have come into us, the vast majority of comments we have received in this proceeding have been from people who run computers with a Linux operating system and are upset that they can't use those computers to watch DVDs. So let's focus purely on those people. Linux users, yes. If, in fact, the Sigma piece of equipment suddenly were available on the shelves of your nearest computer equipment store, would there still be a problem for Linux users? Or would Linux users basically, would you have to say on behalf of Linux users, assuming you're speaking on behalf of them, well, fine, that problem is solved. No need for the librarian to address that aspect of the problem.
Well, I think it would depend on the terms of the license in, for CSS. The thing that is so attractive to people for using Linux is their ability to manipulate their own software on their own machines. And if the Linux player prohibits people's ability to use their machines and to manipulate the software and images in ways that they have a legal right to do, I think we'd still have a problem. So I want to wait and see this machine and what it does and what it doesn't do.
Okay. Let me ask a question for any of the representatives of the copyright owners who would like to take a stab at it. And I recognize we've heard this in 100 different ways over the 5 days of testimony, but if someone could just sort of put it in a nutshell, why is it that we want to protect technological measures that control access to copyrighted works? Why is it important to do that?
I'll answer that question on two levels. One that I think is we should never overlook is that it's important because Congress has decided it's important. And that obviously constrains what this rulemaking proceeding can do within that determination that's already been made. But I think the larger reason, the reason why Congress decided that it was important to protect it, is that these types of measures are really key enabling tools for electronic commerce. And if we're serious about developing electronic commerce in works of authorship, then we have to recognize, as you've heard from today from Sony Computer Entertainment America and from Time Warner and MPAA, that commerce is not going to exist or is going to be extremely stunted and distorted unless copyright owners have the ability to use these types of technological control measures, that they have the ability to manage and control access to their works or to disseminate them more broadly, and that they have the legal backup to prevent or to deal with instances of circumvention. So if we want to see a thriving electronic marketplace in these works, we need to have these tools to do that, and Congress recognized that. So did the other countries, under some countries that adopted the WIPO treaties. And I think that was a real, it was a very important step, because this is a new aspect to international discipline in the field of copyright. It really is not like what has been done in the Berne Convention and TRIPS. It goes a step beyond that. And I think that was fueled by a recognition that this is essential. We need these tools in order to make copyrighted materials available around the world in global electronic marketplace.
Having it paid for, and copyright owners are not going to create the value.
I would also like to supplement that. While the protections for technical, while the legal protections for technical protection measures are new in our copyright law in the DMCA and are relatively new in international treaties only dating back to 1996 with the adoption of the two WIPO treaties, the concept of giving legal protection to technical measures that control access to works is not new. the Communications Act of our United States law as passed by Congress has protected encrypted broadcast signals, whether they be radio signals or television signals, for decades. I cannot tell you exactly from when that law dates. I have it back in my office, and I'd be happy to do a supplemental submission on that. But there's the Satellite Home Viewer Act of, I think, 1988 or 1984, and section, I think it is 301 or 201 of the Communications Act beforehand, which prohibits the unauthorized descrambling of encrypted signals for exactly the reasons that have been stated by the other speakers, that it has been deemed necessary to provide that legal backup for these technical protection measures to facilitate commerce in copyrighted broadcasts or signals, or now in the new digital environment, other works that can be made available in electronic form.
Now, CSS, clarify for me, CSS is an access control device or a copy control device or both?
I'm so glad you asked that question. Because, see, this is the way CSS works. And can I give a little bit of background on this?
As much as you need to answer it, yes.
Originally, when content owners were looking to try and protect their content on this new digital format of DVD, they tried to come up with a legislative approach whereby copy control flags would be inserted in the DVDs, which is strictly a copy control technology. And playback devices, whether they be consumer electronic devices or computers, would be mandated by legislation to look for and respond to those copy control flags. So that would have involved strictly a copy control technology as enforced by law, somewhat similar and based on the Audio Home Recording Act. The Motion Picture Association of America entered into negotiations with the consumer electronics companies to develop exactly such a technological system and legislative structure. Those discussions resulted in a draft piece of legislation called the Digital Video Home Recording Rights Act, or Home Recording Act, something like that, DVRA, I think we refer to it. When those discussions were opened up to the computer industry said, no, we cannot sign on to this. We do not agree with the concept of having Congress mandate that our devices look for and respond to copy control flags and content. Copy control flags are essentially ancillary data that are easy to get lost. It would be very burdensome to make our machines have to look at all the streams of data, especially digital data, which basically are just ones and zeros, and have to assertively look for these copy control flags. We won't do it. We won't sign up for it. And the strength of that view of the computer industry is really demonstrated in the law, in the no mandate provision of the DMCA, where there is no mandate to affirmatively look for copy protection measures. So here we were after months, if not years of work, kind of back at square zero. What are we going to do? The computer industry did acknowledge that making our films available in digital format did pose works. We did, after months of weeks and months of discussions, get them to realize that, unlike software, Warner Brothers is still exploiting Casablanca in version 1.0. We don't update it. We don't change it. It's the same classic movie that we exploit. So once somebody has a copy of it, they don't have an incentive to get the revised copy. The work is the work. Understanding that, the computer industry came back to us and said, fine, this is our position. If data is coming to our machines in the clear, meaning unencrypted, descrambled, we believe we have no obligation to look for any copy control flags, to look for any copy protection devices, or to really follow any rules with respect to that data. Data comes in the clear, and our machine should be able to do whatever they like with that data and send it out the machine in the clear. This is completely apart from any copyright rules or the fact that if a user is making unauthorized copies that he may be infringing copyright law. They said, but if that data is scrambled, if it is encrypted, and we want our machines, our computers, to make use of that data, then we have a choice. We can either sign up and get a license to decrypt that data and follow the rules and conditions that are in that license, or our machines will simply pass along the encrypted data, keeping it in encrypted form. We agree that our devices and machines should not be permitted to simply descramble and hack through an encryption system without any sort of authorization or permission. Having reached that understanding, that is the basis upon which we built the CSS system. The CSS system, called Content Scramble System, involves initially scrambling the content on the DVD disk. So it is encrypted, even though that's completely transparent to the user, because when you put your DVD into your DVD player or your DVD computer, in most circumstances, you just press play and the disk plays. So you don't even necessarily realize that it's encrypted, but the disks are encrypted. Those devices, whether they be players or personal computers or the Sony PlayStation, who would like to have their devices be able to display and play back those DVD discs, need to get a license to be able to decrypt the CSS encryption system. They do that by going to the DVD CCA and applying for a CSS license. That CSS license gives them the keys to and tools to be able to decrypt the discs. It also imposes certain conditions on what the device can do with the content once it is decrypted. One of those obligations, for example, is that the content is not allowed to flow out in the clear on a digital output. Another example of an obligation is that the device has to insert macrovision on content before it goes out the analog output. So by this combination of encryption technology and licensing, you have really a structure that involves access control and copy protection.
Well, it sounds to... I'm sorry, someone else?
I was just about to jump in with a comment. I mean, I think this discussion needs to step back a little bit and look at the DMCA. As Professor Samuelson mentioned in her comments to the court in one of the CSS cases back in New York, that these DMCA access provisions, circumvention provisions, are really an adjunct means of regulating copyright infringement. They're not really an end in themselves, particularly when we're talking about a lot of different situations. We've got broadcast situations, we've got pay-per-view situations, you've got end users that actually buy a copy of the copyrighted work. It really has to be viewed in that context, that this is a means of regulating copyright infringement rather than an end in itself. I think it's also important to, as you look at these things, to think a little bit about what these access control mechanisms do. For example, the WIS code that's used by Sony is not really a copy protection system. What it does is it limits the games that can be played on a PlayStation console. This serves a variety of purposes. By linking together this access control system with the patents that Sony has obtained that relate to that access control system, Sony's created a system where PlayStation video games can only be published by licensed game developers. So they use this as a means to control the ability of people to make games that can be played on a PlayStation console, so that they maintain control over all of the creative works that can be used on that console system. They also use it to put in place these regional controls that we talked a little bit about before. And so this WIS code, it doesn't prevent copying of the discs. I mean, you can copy a PlayStation disc. It may or may not copy that WIS code, but you can copy the PlayStation disc and access the information off that copy on a device other than a PlayStation console. So, I guess the thrust of my comment is really to keep in mind that core purpose of access circumvention control as an adjunct to copyright infringement, which is what this is really all about, preventing infringement of people's copyrights. I wanted to mention David Herbelsheimer has showed up. I think you may want to jump in here with a quick comment on the same subject. If that's
well, we'll get a chance in a while, but I sort of like to stick with what I was talking about with Mr. Marks. It strikes me that what you're describing is perhaps a copy and control device in access control clothing. In other words, you've got a device that controls access to a work, but not in the way that certainly before this rulemaking began, I thought we were talking about when we were talking about access control device. In other words, I assumed, naively perhaps, that a technological measure that controls access to a work, that the purpose of that is to make sure that authorized users and only authorized users are getting access to the work, so that if I paid the price to the copyright owner to be able to use that work, then I'm entitled to use it. And if she didn't, and she somehow gets access to it by circumventing encryption or passwords or whatever, then she's in trouble because she's not an authorized user. I'm not in trouble because I am. That's got nothing to do, as far as I can tell, with what you're talking about. What you're really talking about, I think, is an access control measure that is designed to channel someone towards a device which has copy control on it. Is that a fair description, or am I misdescribing?
I think it's partially a fair description. I think it is also used, the fact that the work is encrypted is used to try and guarantee that the user has legitimate access to the work as well. I mean, I don't think it's completely devoid, the CSS system, of trying to ensure that those people that, for example, would just simply duplicate the DVD discs, you know, pirates would duplicate the DVD discs, and if there were pirate players that were unlicensed, they wouldn't be able to play those discs because they were encrypted with CSS. That serves an access control function as well.
But a duplicated
DVD disc is going to duplicate the CSS encryption.
And can be played
on any legitimate player. Legitimate licensed CSS player cannot be played on non-licensed players.
Okay, so I don't see how you're stopping the piracy of DVDs in that respect. Pirated DVDs can be sold on the open marketplace and played in any legitimate DVD player.
Without infringing copyright?
No, certainly not.
Okay.
But pirated goods are on the market all the time. Maybe they're infringing copyrights. That's very nice to know. They're still out there.
That's right.
So I'm trying to figure out what this technological measure is doing, and I'm not seeing it as really in any way restricting access to authorized users. I'll get to you in a moment, Steve. In other words, there's no reason to believe as a general proposition that someone who has a commercially manufactured and marketed DVD manufactured by Sony, perhaps, or any of the major studios, Time Warner, whatever, is not an authorized user. If someone has that DVD, which is manufactured by Time Warner, you're going to presume they're an authorized user.
Yes, although you have to sort of define what you mean by authorized user. If someone has purchased a DVD from Time Warner, they're authorized to play it on a licensed DVD player. They can play it as many times as they want. There's no restriction on saying it's a one-time play, it's a two-time play. Are they authorized to make reproductions of it? Are they authorized to copy it to their hard drive? Are they authorized to redistribute it in electronic form? The answer is no. So what do you mean by authorized user?
Are they authorized to view it on any machine they can find, which they can make to view it?
No.
And
they're
why not?
Authorized to view it on a licensed device. If someone were to buy a VHS cassette and they didn't have a VHS player, are they authorized to disassemble the video cassette, reproduce the film in there in 35 millimeter print and play it on the movie camera? I don't think so.
Okay, but first of all, there's no contractual privity between the purchaser of that DVD and Time Warner, I assume. There's no shrink wrap license. You don't sign a license saying, I agree only to play this on an authorized player when you purchase the DVD.
That's correct, and neither is there a shrink wrap license when you buy a VHS cassette that's an NTSC format and you only have a PAL player.
Okay, I go to Europe. I buy a video cassette. It's PAL. I bring it back here, and I want to play it, and I find, oh, my God, I got an NTSC player, of course. What was I thinking?
Right.
But wait a minute. I can take it down to a shop, and they can convert it to for me to NTSC, and they'll make a copy
right.
for my own personal use for
right.
NTSC. Would doing that be a violation of Section 1201A?
It would not be a violation of Section 1201A because that's not a technical protection measure. The fact that
okay.
it's in PAL, it's not a technical
okay.
or encryption. It's not a form of technical protection measure. I thought you were going to ask me, frankly, would that be a violation of copyright? And I'm not sure I have the answer to that. A commercial service that is reproducing copyrighted films into different formats,
interesting
I think they
question.
Might well be violating
yeah, we don't have to resolve that here. I don't think it has any bearing.
I'm glad we don't have to.
but getting back to what we were talking about, I'm still troubled. The kinds of things you were talking about, yes, if I buy the DVD, I certainly don't have the right to make copies of it. I'll grant you that. But why don't I have the right to put it on my computer that may be running a Linux operating system, and maybe I can't get a hold of any equipment that is authorized and licensed that will allow me to view that DVD player. But if I can get a hold of that DCSS code, and if I can manage to crack that myself so that I can view it on my own computer, where's the problem? Whose
yeah.
rights have I violated?
Okay, I'm a little uncomfortable about talking about DCSS because of the ongoing litigation.
Well, let me tell you that you better get comfortable because this is a rulemaking that could affect DCSS.
That's fine. But you know, let me try and answer the question for you. It's a matter of balance. As I was trying to describe before, if I can, as an individual user, circumvent the technical protection measure on a DVD disc and copy that content to my hard drive, there is a risk that the content owner has that the use by that individual will not simply be home viewing, but may also be infringing, making unauthorized reproductions, making distributions over the internet. This is not sort of speculative use. People do that with MP3 files all the time today of music. Given that degree of risk, the inconvenience that is posed to a user who purchases a DVD disc but doesn't have a DVD player, which he can get for under $200, or a software program that he can install on his computer or her computer to play the disc, if you balance those out, I think the inconvenience to the individual user is far outweighed by the risk to the copyright owners and the risk to the general public that if this sort of circumvention is permitted, the millions of DVDs that are sold today may not be sold tomorrow because content owners may decide it's simply too great of a risk for them to put their content on that digital format. That's the balancing that needs to take place, in my view.
And I'm not sure you've got the wrong balance there philosophically, but just looking at the scheme we have in Section 1201, Congress made the judgment that it was not going to make it unlawful for an individual to circumvent a technological measure that controls the use of a work, copying and so on.
Right.
It did make the judgment that it would make it unlawful to circumvent a technological measure that controls access to the work. And again, isn't this access control measure, CSS that you're talking about, a measure that is really designed as its end not to control access but to control the use by challenging you to that device whose purpose is to control use?
Well, I think the problem is it's mixed. I mean, as I was trying to describe, we could not put in an effective technological measure that would not fail us with respect to the known mandate provision in the DMCA without employing encryption, which is an access control technology. So the very structure of the DMCA itself, in terms of the no mandate provision, kind of forced our hand to go to the structure. Now, I want to be very clear. We already had devised the CSS structure prior to the implementation of the DMCA in October of 1998, but it only reinforced that structure that we moved to as a result of the computer industry saying to us, if the content scrambled, we will not descramble it. We will not have our machines to scramble it without authorization. If the content is in the clear, don't ask us to try and follow any rules with respect to that content.
You don't want to jump in, so.
If I may, just three reactions to your to this line of questioning. First, I've said it before, and I'm sure we'll say it again, but it is significant that and you're drawing a distinction between access controls that are set up with the goal of preventing infringement, piracy, unauthorized uses, and some other types of access controls that perhaps don't have that close a link. It is significant to me that Congress did not make that distinction. Congress did not say that access control mechanisms that are for some pure, noble purpose other than preventing piracy have a privileged status and more protection against circumvention than those that are, as I think Dean has indicated, closely linked to the preventing or dealing with the huge risk of rampant piracy that CSS is intended to address. And since this is not a congressional committee but a rulemaking created by Congress, I think those it's important to respect both the distinctions Congress did make and the distinctions Congress didn't make. Secondly, I don't think that the type of system that CSS represents is quite as brand new and unprecedented as your question might have implied. I don't think it's really much different in kind from other types of access controls, such as what we've heard before and probably you heard earlier this week, a license that would only allow access to certain material from certain designated machines, designated by IP number or some other fashion. Now, that's not exactly the same as ones as only allowing it from licensed players, but it's similar in the sense that it is an access control that it manifests itself by saying this material may be accessed on certain machines and not on other machines. And again, that's exactly the kind of access control Congress had in mind when it enacted 1201A1 and that it wanted this rulemaking to look at. And finally, it just strikes me that this whole CSS issue is very, it's almost a model or case of a business case of a problem, if it is one, that can be solved by the marketplace, and probably is being solved by the marketplace. If there isn't currently a freestanding Linux player, Linux plugin that can be used to play DVDs on a Linux-based computer, if there's a market to do that, it strikes me that having to pay $10,000 for the license, if the market is more than, you know, a couple of thousand people, that's probably a pretty good deal, and that market need will be filled. And similarly with other, I think it's also important to recognize that we sometimes think of the only platforms for playing DVDs as DVD players and computers, but in fact, I would venture to say that at least in Japan today, neither of those is the main way that people watch DVDs. The main way they watch DVDs is using their PlayStation 2, and that did more to advance the sales of DVDs in Japan than anything else. And that may someday be the case here. There are going to be many platforms. There already are, and there are going to be more. I think the only thing that perhaps makes it a little difficult for us to see that this is an issue that the market is going to solve and that people will have access to a wide variety of platforms on which to play DVDs is that there's kind of a theological taint to this as well. I think we ought to get it out in the open. And even if the plug-in for playing, for example, for playing a DVD on Windows were available for free, and maybe it is for all I know, I don't know what the strategy is for distributing that, there are people, probably some in this room, that wouldn't do it because they don't want their machines to be tainted by anything that emanates from Redmond, Washington. That's a fact, and if that constitutes a sufficient market, that market need is going to be fulfilled. But it is a little different from the typical market situation where people aren't theologically motivated in their decisions, but they're motivated by other factors of what's cheapest and what's most efficient and what works best and so on and so forth. So I think that sometimes clouds the picture a little bit and makes it a little harder to see that this is really a marketplace issue that the marketplace is likely to resolve. And the result is going to be that virtually anybody that wants to watch DVDs on any platform that's readily available will be able to do so.
If
one of the underlying assumptions of your question, if I can be so presumptuous, is that if you have bought a DVD disc, you have the right to access the content that's on the DVD disc. And so if you don't have the appropriate playback equipment, why shouldn't you be able to circumvent the protections to get at the content? I think that argument would be more powerful if, in fact, the content was only released on a DVD disc. But in fact, if you want to see The Matrix, you don't have to buy a DVD to do so. You could see it in the theater. You could see it on VHS. So the fact that the work is available in many alternative formats seems to me to also justify the fact that one should not permit circumvention of a technical protection measure by a user simply because the user has chosen to purchase the work in a format for which the user doesn't have an appropriate player and for which alternative players are available in the market at very consumer-friendly prices. It seems like a fairly weak argument to me.
But it is my understanding that the quality of what you see on DVD is much better than what you see on VHS, for example. It's also my understanding that oftentimes when you get a motion picture on DVD, there's a lot of added value material that you don't get on the VHS. So doesn't that weaken your counter-argument?
Precisely why consumers go out and buy new equipment. When CDs were first released, nobody had CD players. Consumers decided that, hey, this is a great format. It's worth my investment in a new piece of playback equipment. I see no difference in the DVD context. If consumers like the new material that's available on DVD, like the new quality that's available on DVD, they have a choice. They can buy the DVD and buy a piece of playback equipment or not.
Ms. Gross, maybe you can help me out because I'm reading my notes, but they're not, I'm not quite sure I'm recalling what you said. But you said something to the effect that, were you saying that someone from MPAA had stated that a person wanting to make fair use of a DVD should have to obtain a license to do so?
That's right.
Repeat that and tell me who it was who said
sure.
that. Sure.
Let me just remember. I was at a conference at Yale Law School a few weeks ago, and General Deputy Counsel of the MPAA, I believe Gechner was his last name, one of the audience members posed him a question and said, I'm a multimedia artist, and I rely on making fair use of clips of videos for creating new works. If I want to use a DVD to copy a small clip of that to include in a new work that I'm going to create, is it your position that I would be required to get a license? And the MPAA said, yes, it is.
Would that be your position, Dean?
My position would be is that I don't think wanting to use clips from a DVD that might constitute and qualify for fair use in a new work would be sufficient justification to circumvent the technological protection measure of the CSS system that's on a DVD. Does that mean that the multimedia artist is completely out of luck? I don't think so, because the multimedia artist can access clips of the content from a VHS copy or, when the content is on screen, make a camcorder copy of the content and use it. And people may laugh about that, but one of the largest sources of piracy of our films is from people bringing camcorders into movie theaters and making camcorder copies and then reproducing them. And you'd be surprised at how good the quality is.
Well, I've seen some of pretty poor quality.
Some are pretty poor quality, some are pretty good quality.
Okay. One last thing I'd like to ask you, Marks, on this subject. You gave a very articulate explanation and justification for the regional codes and the way in which motion pictures are marketed. Given all that, however, why should it be a violation of the law for an individual who may go to Europe or Asia or wherever and pick up a DVD of a motion picture there and bring it home to circumvent for his or her own personal use so he or she can view that DVD in his or her own home? Why is that a problem?
It really goes to the same question you asked about the access control. Why it's a problem if they don't have a player. It's because of the fact that the technological protection measure is not only dealing with access, but is also dealing with subsequent uses of the content. I would like to just say a couple of points about the regional code in which I missed it.
Okay.
And which some of my colleagues pointed out to me. Another reason why we need regional coding, why we do regional coding, is that the law in various territories is different with regards to censorship requirements. So we cannot simply distribute the same work throughout the world in the same version. Local laws impose censorship regulations on us that require us to both exhibit and distribute versions of the films that comply with those censorship requirements. In addition, the way at least the economics of our business currently work, when we license distribution of our works to licensees in other countries, whether it be video distributors or broadcast distributors, often a precondition in the license contract that the distributor seeks is that the film has had a theatrical release in the U.S. prior to being exploited in the foreign country. So those are two other additional considerations as to why the regional coding scheme is in place in the first place.
Now, if I understand your explanation why it's a problem even to let the individual user circumvent to watch that foreign DVD, it's not that it would be such a horrible thing for the copyright owner if one individual happened to see it in his or her home at a time when he shouldn't have, but that it's linked to these other protections.
That's correct. If there was some way to guarantee that a person who was circumventing the CSS protection technology to view a Region 2 disc on a Region 1 player was only going to view that disc on the player in the privacy of his or her own home without further distributing or copying the disc, it would be less of a problem. There are still the problems associated that I described before about the windows of exploitation, which would make it problematic if you're one individual with the entire population of Italy that, in the privacy of their own homes, circumvented regional coding to play a DVD of a movie that had never been theatrically, that had not yet been theatrically released in Italy and was scheduled. Yeah, that would have a detrimental impact on us. But in your hypothetical of a single individual user, I would say yes. If that single individual user was circumventing solely to be able to view the content of the DVD disc in the privacy of their own home, with some ironclad guarantee that circumvention was not going to lead to further risks of unauthorized reproduction and distribution, I would agree with you.
Why is it that CSS had to be designed in such a way that someone who circumvented in order to overcome the regional coding also necessarily would be circumventing the copy protections? Couldn't you have done it in a different way that wouldn't have been a problem?
It isn't that it's necessarily designed that way. Let me back up. The way the CSS system works is that the content in the clear is restricted from being made available on the hard drive of a computer or what's known as a user accessible bus. I can only speak to the unauthorized decryption systems that have the hack, frankly, of DSS that has occurred to date. And with that hack, the content of the DVD disc is made available in the clear on a computer user's hard drive. And so that is a problem. We didn't design it so that any attempts to circumvent would mean it killed the whole system, but in fact, the circumvention device program that's been developed to date accomplishes that and poses that risk. And you know, the problems with that is that circumvention device is distributed with messages that say, here it is, copy DVDs to your heart's content, send them to your friends. So it sort of poses the parade of horrible risks that we're concerned about.
On the subject of regional coding, Ms. Gross, spent a fair amount of time talking about that as being a problem, and I'm trying to figure out how big a problem it really is. I mean, how many U.S. residents actually go abroad and bring back foreign DVDs and then find themselves frustrated by their inability to play them?
I think many probably do. I don't have a number, I don't have a statistic, but I think it's fairly common when you travel. You like to, myself, I like to get music from whatever region I'm in and bring it back home with me. I'm sure some people are perhaps the same way for movies. And so I think it's a huge problem, but again, I don't have a number, that this number of people buy DVDs abroad, that I can't tell you.
You think it's huge enough, though, that we should make an exemption to a right that Congress has said that copyright owners have a right to do, just because you think that there may be a few people, or maybe even quite a few people, who might find themselves inconvenienced in that way?
Well, I think I know that we are. I think that judging from the enormous number of comments that were received from people complaining about their inability to watch their DVDs, that it is a problem. It's a rather large problem, and it also is a problem outside of the U.S. The copyright offer, the proceeding here was not just designed to decide whether or not U.S. residents would be able to watch their DVDs, but whether people in general were allowed to watch their would be restricted from non-infringing uses. And if you think about an entire worldwide audience of people who want access to watching DVDs from a worldwide market, from a worldwide producers, that's a large number.
Are you saying that Section 1201 has extraterritorial application? I'm not sure I follow
what
you're saying.
No, I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying that there's a lot of people in the U.S. and in the world who are prohibited.
Okay, but I'm trying to figure out why we should be concerned about people elsewhere in the world who are prohibited, because I don't understand how Section 1201 affects them, and therefore I don't understand why we should be considering an exemption to Section 1201 for their benefit.
Well, I think it's also important to note that it's not just when you travel that you want to get a DVD and bring it back, but you simply can't purchase or order DVDs from foreign distributors. If you want, maybe you want to get a DVD, an Indian movie, and you're prohibited from playing it on your device when you bring it when it arrives in the mail.
Moment. The Indian producer, the Indian film producer, is not prohibited from producing DVD discs that would be playable on Region 1 machines. So, for example, we produce DVD discs that are playable on Region 1 discs and Region 2 discs and Region 3 discs, and there's no prohibition on a producer from producing DVD discs that are playable on different regions. And in fact, the producer has the ability to produce a single DVD disc that would be playable on all regions. If you have a producer, a content owner, who is not concerned about the windows of exploitation, they can produce a DVD disc that's multi-region and playable on all regional players throughout the world. So there is flexibility built into the system.
I may be exhausting your knowledge here, but let's take that example. India has, I think, the second largest film industry in the world.
First,
okay. And yet, outside of India, the market for those films is probably fairly limited.
Right.
Do you know whether most Indian films are coded so that on DVDs so that they can be viewed worldwide, or are they simply regionally coded?
You know what? I don't know. But I will try and find out. I don't even know if Indian producers are making their films available on DVD, but
yeah,
I will try
question.
And find that out.
Okay.
I just wanted to clarify what I was saying. Was
okay.
That the notice of inquiry was requesting whether or not there was harm to people, and it didn't ask whether or not there was harm to U.S. people.
Okay.
So that's
but let's keep in mind that ultimately what we're trying to do here is figure out whether we should recommend an exemption,
sure.
And that exemption, I don't think, can directly affect what happens outside the United States. All right, so the harm I've heard from you so far, I want to make sure I've got your catalog of problems here with DVDs. We've got the problem for people with Linux operating systems, which some people would say is being resolved or may soon be resolved depending upon how available this driver is, I guess. You've certainly got your doubts about that. We've got the problem of regional coding. What are the other specific problems we've got that we need to be worried about with respect to DVDs?
The fact that fair use is completely prevented. As we've heard here today, people are required to get a license in order to make a fair use of a DVD. This idea that, well, you can simply go out and buy a VHS, it doesn't work. And it doesn't work because DVDs are a completely different experience than a VHS. They have director's cuts. You can look at different shot angle, different camera angles. There's all sorts of additional information that is included in the DVD that you simply cannot get on a VHS. There is no equivalent to a DVD. So fair use is severely impacted. It's simply prohibited.
What are the fair uses of a DVD that you can't engage in under the current regime?
If I want to make a backup copy for my own personal use, if I want to take
okay, let's stop with that. What case law tells you have a fair use right to make a backup copy of the DVD for your own personal use?
I think that Sony, the Universal City, says that.
Really?
Interesting proposition.
I don't think so.
Software law specifically allows you to do that, and DVDs certainly fall under software.
DVDs fall within Section 117, is that what you're saying?
DVDs are software.
Okay, are you saying they're covered by Section 117?
I'm not really sure what 117 is.
Okay, you might want to take a look at it and let us know in your post-hearing comments.
But I think that the Ninth Circuit decision in the Diamond Rio case that people have a fair use right to copy an entire song onto their computer hard drives for personal use, I think you'll find a lot of that.
You might want to cite a few cases to us then, too.
I will do that.
I'm not terribly familiar with a whole lot of case law that says you can do that. Let's go on. What are the fair uses, are there, that you're saying can't be done right now?
Well, in one of the affidavits submitted in the DCSS case was Professor Charlie Nesek from Harvard Law School, who talked about how he typically would like to use a portion of a DVD from the movie Client, I think it was, as part of educating the law students on how to handle certain situations. And if he's now prohibited from taking that snippet of a DVD and showing it to his students, that's an educational use that is prohibited.
Okay, he could do that with a VHS version, correct?
Well, he might be able to, but there's no guarantee that he could, and perhaps...
Why is there no guarantee that he could? What on earth could stop him?
Because there's no guarantee that the film will be released in VHS. There's no guarantee that the DVD is the same equivalent content.
Okay, that particular film is in VHS right now,
isn't
it?
That film may be.
Okay,
but
we're talking about now and the next 3 years. Are you seriously telling me that there are films that are going to be released in DVD in the next 3 years that will not be available in VHS?
I think that's right.
Why do you think that's right?
Because they're completely separate products, a DVD and a VHS.
Well, they're the same film, although the DVD may have added value.
I think they're very different. When you incorporate all the additional information and the incredibly rich multimedia experience that DVD provides, it's not at all the same.
Professor Nesson wants to show a film clip from the motion picture. He's going to be able to do that with a VHS version. There's no question, is there?
He'll be able to do it with a DVD version. I mean, if he has a DVD player in his classroom, Section 110 covers the use of display in the classroom. There's no prohibition on that.
I'm just baffled. I don't know how he can't do what you're saying he can't do with what's available to him now. And I think Mr. Marks is correct. He can take a DVD player into the classroom and a TV, and he can show that clip.
As long as that movie is available in that format, that's true.
Well, if it's not available in that format, he's in trouble anyway, because we're talking about a DVD right now and a DVD player. I'm sorry, I'm just trying to understand the fair uses that people can't engage in using the currently authorized equipment, and so far I haven't heard any.
Playing their DVD on their computer.
Okay, we've talked about that. Let's talk about fair use, though. What are the fair uses that are prevented under the current regime?
If I want to make a small copy or a small excerpt of a certain part for a certain reason that's only available in DVD, I'm prohibited.
Is that correct, Mr. Marks?
Are you talking about legally prohibited
I'm
or
talking
having
about
technically, okay. making it technically difficult to do so?
I'm talking about technically prohibited.
Again, my answer would be that yes, it's when it comes out, the analog output, it'll be protected by Macrovision, and yes, the content will not go out of digital output at the beginning, so it makes it more technically difficult to make a copy of a small clip from a DVD. Is it impossible? No. And that's the camcording example that I used. When it is running, you can copy a snippet of it on a camcorder.
So your answer
may not be convenient. It may not be the best copy quality that you would like, but I don't believe the fair use doctrine says that a user gets to take fair use copies of the best format and best quality that the work is available. Nobody has ever argued that film studios have to make 35mm theatrical prints available to users who want to take out clips or snippets for the purpose of fair use.
So you're basically saying analog is good enough for fair use?
Yeah, I am.
Access versus fair use, that if this person wants to copy them, they have to circumvent Macrovision in order to make the snippet. I thought that that was covered under fair use in some of the comments I saw from Meredith Peters actually early on before Congress, that access versus infringement, or am I just totally out of my mind?
We're not psychiatrists. We couldn't tell you.
Okay, sorry.
Thank you.
In actually being able to copy the works, I thought we were talking more here about access than really talking about copying the works. If this professor wants to copy the work of the Macrovision output that comes out and they circumvent the technological measure for that purpose, that's very separate from what we're talking about here in 1201A for access in particular.
Well, the point's a fair one, that if the access control is preventing you from having the means to make a copy, which might be fair use, then maybe you have a problem. I think that's Ms. Gross's point.
That already exists, I guess, with Macrovision and the copying that's out there. Argue the other side of things, I'm just trying to understand it as well.
Okay. Since all copying is prohibited by the DVDs, fair use by definition is prohibited.
All right.
I think that's a mistaken conception of fair use. To equate fair use with copying is almost like equating fair use with consumption. I mean, fair use can involve, not literally copying a work, but copying some of the expression of a work for parody, copying some of the expression of a work for criticism and comment. It's not just about physically copying the format that the work happens to be in.
Well, I'm trying to think. Aside from the time-shifting situation in Sony, have there been cases holding that the actual copying of a motion picture is fair use?
The Diamond Multimedia decision, RIAAB Diamond.
It's not a motion picture, though.
MP3s, but...
And there's there's an Audio Home Recording Act that has the serial copy management piece in that says there's no infringement when you make the copy.
That's correct.
So I think we're going into, at best, maybe a murky area as to whether fair use is even available in that context. I'd be interested in hearing or seeing some authority from you about actual replication of portions of motion pictures as being fair use. Because I'm not sure the case law's out there, but I may have overlooked it.
I think that the Sony v. Universal Cities case was about people's ability to make a complete copy of a complete movie.
In the context of time shifting, you're absolutely right.
Time shifting of free
over the air
television. Yeah. Sony versus Betamax does not stand for the proposition that you can make a complete copy of a work from pay-per-view television, from a video cassette, from a DVD. It simply does not stand for that proposition. Fair use always balances the rights of the copyright owner and the use interests that are being asserted by the putative fair use user. It's not an absolute.
Mr. Handgarten or Mr. Herbelsheimer, feel free to jump in. First of all, you mentioned a decision just handed down here in the Northern District of California. We're not aware of that decision, but we'd certainly like to know more about it. If you have a copy, we'd like to see it.
There actually is not a written decision yet. It was an oral ruling from the bench last Tuesday in the case Sony Computer Entertainment America versus Connectix Corporation.
Well, this is on remand?
This was on summary judgment. Connectix moved for summary judgment on the DMCA claim brought by Sony, which was claiming that it was a circumvention device.
And
the court granted summary judgment for Connectix. The transcript should be available next week. We could provide a copy if you'd like that.
Yeah, that would be great. And I gather you expect a written decision to be forthcoming, or?
It's not clear. The court was not clear if it would be doing a written decision in the near future or if it would be holding off on a written decision until sometime in the future. But I think the transcript it'll contain the court's comments regarding a written decision on it.
Okay. One thing I wasn't able to get out of your testimony is what classes, if any, you are advocating that we recommend the librarian exempt from Section 1201A. you have a suggestion for us.
Well, the thing that I threw out right off the top of my head was it going the most narrow. I mean, I'm not sure of his name, but the fellow over here in the green tie who was talking earlier mentioned that one way to look at this is to start from the very specific and move to the more general. And so I was sort of throwing out to start from the very specific. In our instance, the particular class of works that Bleem is most concerned about at this point is PlayStation video games, which are produced on CD-ROM. Now, I know David's been thinking a bit about other classes of work, and maybe I'll turn it over to him. This is one of these things that I'm sure we'll have an awful lot to say about in our post-hearing comments, but it's how you move from that very specific example, which... as I described earlier, you've got a class of works which are distributed without license that are actually sold, so the person acquires a copy of it, and they're sent out on a CD format that is accessible. So it's a very specific type of disc that forms that very particular class of works. Now, whether there is that class of works should be defined more generically than PlayStation video discs is an issue that I think requires some thought. How you can create a class of works that strikes the right balance here. I don't know if David, you have thoughts on that?
More with the way that we've seen 1201 used specifically against us, or the Japanese variant of that law used against some of our retailers in Japan, is that it seems to be being used to expand the scope of copyright beyond where it already affords protection for copying, for infringement, for a lot of areas, that they're taking this sort of technological measure and applying almost a self-help program that some content providers can use to really lock down their content and limit the ability of end users to actually not just have fair uses, but have uses at all to the content that they have gone out and lawfully purchased, copies of copyrighted works. And the imposition of expanding 117 to go beyond, or not 117, excuse me, 1201 to go beyond what I've seen in some of the early history and some of the statements again from Ms. Peters, really talking about it being something to expand the growth of digital networks and to allow copyrighted works to be disseminated more freely over digital networks by protecting the rights of copyright holders. And we're all in favor of that because we produce content just like everybody else here, you know, that we want to have our works protected. Talking about here specific accesses of watching a one-time pay-per-view movie or playing a copyrighted video game over a network where you need to protect that content to make sure it doesn't just get kind of sucked off and reproduced. I think it's a different issue when you start taking that protection to access, where the encryption is really essential to protecting the work over that network, and then trying to apply it to areas where there are already substantial and very effective protections against infringement. To start wrapping access around that starts, I think, hobbling the ability of users to actually use their works and gives an unfair amount of control, I think, to the copyright holder that's beyond the rights that they should have under the copyright law, the rights that this act is supposed to support.
Mr. Russell, did someone else start? If I don't happen to have the Sony PlayStation equipment, but I've got a Sony PlayStation game, why on earth shouldn't I be allowed to use the Bleem emulator so I can play that game on my computer or on the Sega equipment or something else?
Well, quite frankly, and I don't want to try our case here, it's not limited to the DMCA claim. We have concerns about other IP rights that we have in these games and in the system and the way we build these games that we have alleged that Bleem and Volt Kinetics has violated. So I think the case goes well beyond what is on issue here, which is 1201 A1A, and that is not, we did not bring any action, of course, against Bleem or Kinetics in those, and the ruling in the court is not under that set of sanctions.
Okay, but what I'm trying to get, let me put it another way. If I did use the Bleem emulator, say, after October 28th of this year, so that I could play one of the PlayStation games on my PC, would it be your position that I would be violating Section 1201?
I think that the issue is an interoperability issue, and I think that is dealt with in the DMCA under, I believe it's 12, I'm not sure, F.
Sure.
F. And I think F amends or is an exemption from 1201A. So, I think that if what we're dealing with here, if it's what we're concerned with, there is a provision that deals with this. And then the question is whether it's a lawful
reverse engineering, you're achieving interoperability. And that is, I'm not going to go through that. That's not, you know, the area of discussion here. And I think that's something that is very, very fact specific and certainly should not be made determined on, you know, in, they come up on an individual basis and shouldn't be determined on a broad exemption by a video game class.
It's just late in the day, so maybe I'm not making myself clear. Maybe I'm not understanding. But what I'm trying to understand is, if I were to use a Bleem emulator, would I, engaging in that conduct, be circumventing some technological measures that Sony has that were designed to restrict my access to the PlayStation game? And if so, would I be violating Section 1201A?
Again, I believe that it will fall under the exemption that falls under 1201F. Because I believe what's happening here is, you know, you may not be violating you may not be circumventing it. You will be having reverse engineered it.
No, I wouldn't be. I'm using
you're the end user. Are you the end user?
I don't believe the end user is. And you don't think the end user is circumventing technological protections either?
The technological protection is in the disk and in the machine, so I don't believe that the end user is.
Okay. That's really what I was getting at. Thanks. Okay.
That's interesting, because that's exactly what they alleged against us in court, is that if the end user isn't doing it by using our product, then our product certainly couldn't be doing it. And this is the thing that I'm really afraid of here in the United States, is what's happening to us right now in Japan. They have a very similar implementation as we do in 1201, their law there, I think, is the Unfair Competition Act, but it's very similar in that it protects against unauthorized circumvention of technological measures that effectively control blah, blah, blah. But they have some very specific language that say that the playing of pirated video games, this is one of the concerns that in our particular circumstance comes up, is that because this WIS code is proprietary to Sony and, in fact, patented, if we were to recognize it, we would be in violation of their patent, because we don't recognize the WIS code, we are violating or we're circumventing their protections. In Japan, they say that the act of playing a pirated game isn't actually an infringement. It's making the copied game is an infringement there. They specifically preclude video games. They specifically speak towards issues like whether or not the protection on the disc is actually voluntary. In the case of video games, it's one where every manufacturer of PlayStation games is required to appoint Sony as part of their license for the development tools. They're required to make them their sole manufacturer of CDs, and that protection is included in the CDs, so is it truly voluntary? In spite of all this, Sony is still going out and going to our retailers there and basically threatening them with lawsuits unless they cease to carry our product and pay back, I don't know, $200 per copy, I think, for every copy they've sold, and write a letter apologizing to Sony for ever carrying it in the first place. And these are the kind of things that, if there's any vagueness or there isn't a clear exemption for certain kinds of uses in the law that we can point to and that we can make clear and understandable. This is in the face of MIDI in Japan actually telling the people, no, we don't see that there's anything wrong with it, but who knows what the judge will say. You know, I'm just afraid that we're going to have the same kind of issues in this country where they can go and they can say, look, Bleem is a product that violates the DMCA. You, by selling it as a store, are in violation of the DMCA. And now, with the further enactments, going down to end users and putting out ads and saying anybody who uses Bleem is in violation of the DMCA, we're going to go after them. Contrary to what he said here today, that's not what they've expressed in court and in numerous threatening letters to retailers.
Quite frankly, I don't feel this is the appropriate forum to try our case.
I'm not trying to try anyone's case. I'm just trying to figure out whether there's an issue here within our domain, which is why I'm asking to
talk. I understand that.
I'd just point out, too, yeah, it's not really a matter of trying the case, but the fact is that Sony and many of the other folks who have spoken here today are putting the burden on the proponents of a specific exemption to establish that there is an impact, and I think that this discussion is relevant to that. This is an actual impact that, despite the fact that A1A is not yet in effect, we can point to provide tangible evidence that there's a real risk of this. And that's the only reason this is coming up. It's not an issue of trying cases here. And, you know, but it's relevant experience that I think bears on this discussion.
Okay.
And we still do have one more comment period at this point.
In response to positions taken at these hearings.
You're done. It is now 46. So instead of going in order, I'm just going to basically ask see if there's anyone here who wants to ask questions. I'm going to go on. Okay, Rachel.
I know it's late and it's hot, so I'll try and keep it really, really brief. Ms. Gross, I was just wondering how you would respond to Mr. Mark's argument that without these technological protections in existence, without the existence of him, his company and other companies wouldn't have put out these products at all. So, you know, in a sense, they're out there, they're doing some consumers some good. Why should the fact that they decided to put them out in a protected format mean that that anybody has a right to circumvent that in lieu of, if we accept his argument that in lieu of these protections, they wouldn't even be on the market?
Well, I wouldn't say anybody has a right, but I think that it's really kind of false to say that people will not create, that society will not create absent this level of technological protection measures. People have always created, and they will continue to create. And I think we can look right now to the music business and what's going on the internet with music and MP3s and companies like MP3.com and eMusic and all sorts of new business models that are coming up and proliferating and all sorts of new artists who are putting their music out there. And society has never had more choice in accessing music legitimately. So I think it's really sort of false to say that society will discontinue creation of intellectual property absent this level of protection.
Okay, Dean, just two really quick questions. Do you currently stagger video, does your company or do you know if other companies currently stagger video releases between the, whatever the initials are, of the U.S. format and the PAL format?
Yeah, there is staggering, really. It depends upon the distribution channels, the media windows of exploitation. Generally, in general, movies are released first in the United States before they are overseas, and in general, this is subject to some exceptions. Video cassettes, video release occurs 6 months after in the United States. So to the extent that the theatrical release in Europe is later than the theatrical release in the U.S., the video release in Europe is later than in the U.S. And in some countries, and I'm not sure it's still the case today, but it's certainly up to recently was the case in France, there was a law that said you could not release on video prior to 6 months after theatrical release, so we're constrained by some of those laws as well. If I may, I just wanted one quick response to Ms. Gross's reply to your question rather. It's late in the day for all of us. I wasn't asserting that absent technical protection measures, people would stop creating. I was saying that absent the ability to use technical protection measures, creators and publishers and distributors may not make their works available on certain formats like DVD. I was not saying that there would no longer be creative activity.
Okay, and one more quick question. I certainly want to get into a long discussion about it at this hour, but I'm curious, the question I posed to Steve this morning about what happens if we do decide that we exempt a class of works. What does that mean under C and D? I'm just curious to hear your answer to that, since we're taking a poll.
Yeah. I was hopeful that Steve's scholarly and forthright answer would settle it for everyone. but I basically agree with what Steve said, and it's on the one hand, I'm sort of sympathetic to the argument that the reference to users in 1201D is users who are making only non-infringing uses. But the problem that I have with that is fair use is, as we all know and as the Supreme Court has said, a balancing test that operates on a case-by-case basis, is very factually intensive. And like in Akoff-Rose, you have courts that at every level of the way reversed one another. So it's hard for me to imagine creating bright-line rules concerning classes of works for non-infringing uses and determining, you know, sort of ab initio what those non-infringing uses are. Is it impossible for all non-infringing uses? No. I would say private viewing of videos, for example, in one's own home is a non-infringing use. Clear enough. But there are all sorts of copying for what purpose or for example, where it's really hard to come up with those bright line rules at ab initio. And so that somewhat leads me to think that maybe Steve is correct, that when 1201D was referring to users, it was referring to users in general and not just users who were making non-infringing uses. But the second point being, if one was limiting it to users who are making non-infringing uses, how do you really monitor and sort of enforce that? It would be rather difficult. That being said, I was very sensitive to Mr. Carson's argument that we don't want to necessarily turn 1201B into the bluntest instrument possible. So I think it's a very complicated question.
Okay. Mark, do you have a response to that?
I'm not sure I agree that the users are to be defined in that way, but I'll have to take another look at it.
Okay. Four questions, I'm done. That's it.
This is in regards to CSS, and I talked a lot about it, but CSS protects both access and the Section 106 rights of the copyright owner.
Right.
As I said before, 1201A1 protects only technical protection measures that protect access.
Right.
And Congress specifically chose not to have a prohibition for circumvention of the conduct of the measures that protect the Section 106 rights.
Right.
So if we have a technical protection measure that does not discriminate between access and copy protection measures, the latter of which was specifically chosen by Congress not to be, that conduct not to be prohibited, who should bear the burden of this indiscriminate use of technology, since Congress did choose that the latter would not be protected? Shouldn't this burden be placed on the copyright owner to show that there's some need for this, or that why the indiscriminate use is necessary?
Yeah, let me answer that in a couple of pieces. One, that I don't think it's indiscriminate use. I was trying to describe through the history of the development of the CSS copy protection structure why the content industry was really, I don't want to say forced, but really led to develop a structure where encryption was the hook. It was because of the reactions we were getting from the computer industry and the fact that we knew these works were going to be played on computer platforms, and by the limits in the law that say if you put a mere copy control technology like an SCMS flag in audio, absent a particular legislative provision like the Audio Home Recording Act that mandates consumer electronic players to look for and respond to SCMS, the law under the DMCA says there is no obligation to respond. So the notion of trying to implement copy protection technology in a way that devices will respond required us to go to a system where encryption was the initial hook. So it's not really an indiscriminate use. Frankly, our only way of trying to implement effective copy protection technology, but I'm not quite done yet, though. Thankfully, in the area of CSS, and this goes to the gentleman, David's remark, in this particular instance, the content flows out the analog output with Macrovision. Macrovision is the copy control technology that inhibits copying of the analog signal, and the CSS license, the condition of the CSS license is that devices, whether they be the computers or the DVD players, apply Macrovision to the signal as it goes out the analog output. If a user circumvents Macrovision in order from on the content of a DVD as it flows out the analog output in order to make a copy, the lack of the prohibition in the law of circumventing copy protection technology by an individual applies. So therefore, if the individual user, and I think this is what you were getting at, were to circumvent Macrovision, it doesn't fall within the 1201A prohibition. It would be a circumvention of a copy control technology that is permitted under the law.
Please.
But I want to clarify if there are any lingering questions on that, because I think it's a very important point.
I'm just going to say your question used the word burden, and we may be confusing two burdens here. In any particular case, if someone were alleging a violation of 1201A1, the plaintiff would have to prove that what was circumvented was an access control. And if that's, you know, an issue, and put into issue, and the burden of proof on that would rest with the plaintiff.
That's correct.
To show that. Here, of course, when we're talking about the burden in this proceeding, things are, that this is a little bit different. Congress has already decided that 1201, that the B circumvention should be outlawed, and the question of exceptions, the burden is on the proponent of exceptions. But I just wanted to clarify.
The burden is on the proponent of the exemptions for the access controls. But here we have some, at least testimony, that there are some adverse effects from, whether they're cured or not is another question. But so there were some showing that there were adverse effects to certain users of this in terms of the access. The hypothetical we had in Congress of going into the bookstore to buy the book doesn't seem appropriate here in terms of access. Here we had legitimate users going into that bookstore and buying the book, the DVD, only to find that then that was locked in addition, and the different uses of that were restricted after that lawful access was...
The way you posed that question really, and it really has come up in a lot of the comments here, you know, it almost sounds like you're raising a consumer protection issue, that somehow the consumer is surprised to find that when she buys a DVD in Europe that she can't play on a U.S. machine, or that... you know, that if you use that late lamented DivX technology, not probably unlamented by many in this room, but that was a technology that was a time limited DVD in effect. I mean, and you could only play it three times or over a certain period of time. I think we have to distinguish between whether someone maybe wasn't aware when they bought it and therefore didn't know what the limitations were, versus the question of whether it's legitimate to have the limitations at all, whether there's some problem from the perspective of this proceeding with using access control mechanisms to enforce those limitations. Now, when people subscribe to HBO, they, I think, generally do know, they're put on notice that it's a time-limited subscription, they can't go back later and put in a black box to get to see again what their subscription has expired to. But, you know, that's a separate, the consumer protection side of that is a separate question from whether, A, the copyright owner can use those access control mechanisms, and B, whether it's illegal to circumvent those. And as Dean's pointed out, for some 20 years it has been illegal to circumvent those protections. So this, again, is not really a new concept.
Steve, I just want to supplement the HBO example, because there had been a comment that the HBO example was irrelevant because... You had paid for your HBO if you were descrambling because you hadn't paid for your HBO subscription, that was a different case for having bought a DVD, paid for it, and not be able to play it. That was not the example that I used in my testimony. The example I used was you had purchased a subscription to HBO, and during the time that you are a legitimate purchaser of HBO service, you own a television set. Granted, there aren't any around today, probably, except maybe in antique stores, but the TV set that was not cable-ready, that could not accommodate a set-top box. The HBO signal would be coming to your home in encrypted form. If you had a television set that could not accommodate the system under the Communications Act, you do not have a right to buy a black box and decrypt the HBO system, the HBO signal, rather, in order to get the content, even if you're a subscriber and have paid for HBO. And that's the point I wanted to try and make.
May I comment on the implication of the question there? I think the question implicates the matter of burden very clearly, and we are to focus on distinct, verifiable, and measurable impacts, isolated or de minimis effects, speculation, conjecture, et cetera, does not amount to meeting a burden. And I think that those effects that are isolated, de minimis, speculation, et cetera, should be regarded as such and not as meeting a burden.
I just want to offer Ms. Gross or anyone else an opportunity.
Just one question on behalf of libraries. Libraries purchase DVDs. And do DVDs degrade? Do they deteriorate? Or do they stay good forever? You're a library that's an archive.
Right. My understanding, and again, this is going to be an additional question for me to research for you, is that the life of a DVD disc is greater than the life of VHS tape, an analog video cassette, that will deteriorate more quickly than a DVD disc will. But it is not my understanding that a DVD disc will not ever degrade over time.
Are you aware of libraries purchasing and then seeking in the purchase the ability to somehow make a backup copy that isn't in exactly the same format, but in a neutral format that they can basically have as machines become not available? Or what, do you know what libraries are doing with regard
to that? Yeah, I don't know, and I haven't heard of any such request being made.
Well, they clearly have a right under Section 108 to the point where it's deteriorating to make the backup copies. And the question is, if you had an access control on it,
right,
wouldn't that then inhibit the ability that they have by law with regard to the copy?
It may, and I think if that sort of problem develops, I think a much more sensible remedy to that problem is for the library and the content owner to work out some sort of guideline whereby the content owner needs to make available and a copy that's suitable for archiving to the library rather than enacting or adopting an exception to the prohibition on circumvention. I understand that 1201A1B really only gives you rulemaking authority in this context to adopt exceptions or exemptions for circumvention. But
there's a question
Library
about preservation.
Has other rulemaking abilities in terms of preservation or archiving or library exceptions, and I think that would be the proper place to address those concerns.
Okay, we'll look at this. It's now after 6 o'clock. I want to thank all the witnesses for... I'm looking around before I do this. Is there anyone else who wants to ask a question on the panel? Is there anyone else out there who wants to say anything? All right, I can say that it's after 6, and that I really do appreciate all the effort that went into people to appear here today, and also your willingness to answer our questions so thoroughly. And I also thank the people who attended. There is one more opportunity to have input into the evidence that we're gathering, and that, of course, is the comments that can come in up to June 23rd on what was raised in the hearing. Thank you very much.